This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Race and Jews, Part 4. I'd like to address several things that have come across my desk over this past week. The first is Richard Dawkins on Twitter. Richard Dawkins is a world-famous author, biologist, evolutionary biologist in particular. And on Twitter, he has over a million followers. So every little utterance that he makes is heard by many, many people. And this particular twit went out to those million, and 325 of them found it so profound that they retweeted it themselves. Another 498 favored it, marked it as a favorite. Dawkins wrote, "Biologists disagree over how or whether to define race, but there is no," and he capitalizes N-O, "sensible definition whether whereby either Judaism or Islam is a race." What Dawkins is doing here is a bit of intellectual sleight of hand. He's playing a word game. He's using, setting aside Islam for the moment, he's using the word Judaism rather than Jews. He's deliberately shifting the attention to the ideological aspect of the Jews, the Judaism part, rather than the biological part, the Jews themselves, the people, which is the only thing it really makes sense to talk about as a race. Now, Dawkins, as I said, is a biologist, a world-famous biologist, very smart man, a white man. And his specialty is evolution. And he's too smart, basically, to not understand that he's making a fallacious argument. In fact, I think he's in a subtle way trying to call attention to this pretense that Jewishness is purely religious or ideological. And this is a pretense that the Jews themselves engage in and promulgate and that many people fall for. I don't think that Dawkins himself falls for it, but I think he's trying to protect himself because he has been a critic of Muslims and Jews, or at least of Islam and Judaism. And he wants to defend himself from the charge of racism, which is often used whenever someone criticizes Jews or Muslims. And that is because of the racial nature of both groups. Islam is a separate issue, but there is race underneath that religion as well. But the thing about this pretense that Jewishness is all about religion, it comes up over and over and over again. It's probably the main dodge that Jews use. And what are they dodging? They're pretending that Jewishness is all about religion and entirely about religion and ideology, in order to basically say that it's not at all biological. That's the part that they consistently try to distract attention away from, to cover up, to excuse, or to otherwise deny or at least minimize. But the Jews, the group itself, not their philosophy or ideology about themselves, the Jews as a group are a racial group. Because what makes a Jew, is whether their parents are Jews. That is the primary, 99% of the people that identify themselves as Jews, that is how they identify themselves, is by whether their parents, one or more of their parents are Jews. I've discussed the details of that. It's they try to confuse the issue by making about whether it's only the mother being a Jew that makes a person a Jew, and it's a whole complicated subject worth several podcasts, and I've already done those, so go back and listen to those if you're not up to speed on that already. The thing about this pretense that Jewishness is about Judaism is the very first question that should come to mind of anyone who's being skeptical or even just intelligent is, what Judaism? What form of Judaism are you talking about? Because there are different types, even of the, if you wanted to restrict your attention to just the parts of Judaism that have to do with religion, there are different, almost entirely different religious facets of that group identity. And there are, of course, atheist Jews, Jews who profess to have no religion at all, don't believe in God, don't believe in the religion, don't celebrate the religious traditions or laws. And they're not excluded in general by other Jews. They're just considered bad Jews. But they're still Jews, and that's because of the racial aspect of it. You can't just change your race by converting the ideas in your head. The Jews recognize that, even though whites, generally speaking, don't. Now, another item that came to my attention was a comment on a recent post by Kevin MacDonald, who I focused on in the last installment. The title of his article was "Get Into Twitter, Be Depressed," and he mentioned several different sources of information that he listens to, both Jews and whites. And his point was this, that he gets depressed from what he hears on Twitter. The comment came from James Reinfeld. He wrote, "Tanstoffel at Age of Treason is doing podcasts on intellectuals such as Francis Parker Yockey and their thoughts, or really their lack of adequate thoughts, on the Jews. The impression I get from these podcasts confirms the frustrations I had myself in looking up the wise old men of the white race for thoughts that might help us in this crisis." He might have mentioned Kevin MacDonald there. Implicitly, I guess he was hoping people would follow the link back and see that my most recent podcast was about MacDonald. But I hadn't really thought about what I was doing. It may seem that I am, but I don't really plan out a long arc of what I'm going to do, what I'm going to talk about. I just sort of pull on a thread and I follow where it leads me. And I try to stay on a particular topic, and that's why I make these multi-part series at least of late. But he accurately describes what it is that the conclusion I've ended up coming to myself about people like Yockey, is, you know, where's the beef? There's no there. There's no substance when it comes to the Jews, and not much more when it comes to race. And because those two subjects are tied together, you really have to understand race in order to understand the Jews, as I said in part one of this particular series. And I am frustrated by this, and I'm disappointed not only in these wise old men of the white race that are referred to me, but by the people who refer to them as exemplars as well, that they see them as these, and they're painted generally as notorious racists, as boogeymen, as I mentioned about Sumner, and social Darwinists in general. But in many of the cases that I've seen, when I actually go and read what these men had to say for themselves, that whatever racial identity and racial understanding that they espouse is pretty much the default, the zeitgeist of the time, the spirit of the age, that many others around them were also speaking of. And people call attention to them mainly because they were famous, not because they were famous for being racist, but because they were famous for some other reason and also made some comments about race. Henry Ford is another good example, although I think Henry Ford had stood head and shoulders above others in his time for his understanding of the Jews, or at least of the men that he hired to investigate the Jews for him and write about what they had learned. I had come to a similar conclusion about some of the anti-Semites, supposed anti-Jews, that I've encountered as well, Wilhelm Marr being the one that comes to my mind first. How disappointingly feeble their criticism of Jews turned out to be when I actually looked at it. And I'll probably dig deeper into that thread, pull on that at some point in the future, try and find others to investigate. But this commenter, James Reinfeld, continues, "Before Kevin MacDonald, no one knew anything about the Jews and the danger to whites as whites. Attempts to grapple with the Darwinian challenge using theological mental tools, passing references to Jewish attitudes and habits with no development on the potential danger they posed and no advice on how whites should defend themselves as whites, or at most, inclusion of Jews on lists of alien peoples who really posed nothing like the same threat as these didn't cut it. Nor is there guidance to be had in hyper-nationalist perspectives that had no notion of whites as an endangered in-group and rather saw some particular nation as in competition with all others, merely including Jews. Jews are and have been conscious of themselves as a collective with shared interests and enemies, while we have been unconscious. This has given Jews an enormous advantage over us. From the publication of the Cultural Critique Trilogy and the additional material that followed, we can say that at least tiny numbers of whites had, for the first time, a matching awareness. That's quite new. Really, it's a 21st century phenomena only." Much of what he says here is true. I see some of my own thinking reflected here. And I'm glad for that. I'm glad I'm having an impact and getting people to see what I spend a lot of time thinking about and trying to describe. I see that some of that's getting across. But I think he's missing here a very obvious point. First of all, Kevin MacDonald is a refreshing exception to the cowardice and ignorance that we're surrounded by in contemporary times. His analysis is comprehensive and it's coherent. But the general thrust that of MacDonald's analysis, that the Jews are biologically alien from Europeans, from whites, and that they conspire deliberately to advance their own interests against the interests of their hosts, of Europeans, of whites, this isn't a new analysis. It isn't a new conclusion. Many Europeans have at various times seen the Jews as implacably alien and harmful, as an existential threat, especially since the Enlightenment. And the National Socialists in Germany, in particular, came to power with that understanding and tried to implement what it would take to save themselves from being destroyed by the Jews, from being exploited and ultimately destroyed. The National Socialists understood the Jews in the same sort of way, to the extent that the science of the day, the understanding of the day, allowed, as Kevin MacDonald does today. He has and we, together with him, have the advantage of hindsight and the things that have happened since the Second World War. James Reinfeld's final point, he says that nor is there guidance to be had in hyper-nationalist perspectives. I agree to a certain extent in that, the way he just adds hyper to the beginning of it, he's putting the emphasis on this, what he fleshes out there in his the rest of his paragraph, that sort of a every country for itself or every nation for itself sort of attitude. What's necessary to divide us and conquer us? What has worked in the past to what resulted in World War I and World War II? This seeing ourselves as a nation against other nations in Europe, and that the Jews are just one of several groups who are our enemies for a time. If only America or Britain or the USSR had awakened to the Jews as the German National Socialists did, then World War II might have been averted, or at least the Jews might have lost that war. Things would be totally different now. And finally, a comment from Andrew on my own blog, commenting on part three of this series. He writes, "I am unsure about the degree of Jewish self-deception versus conscious deception. I tend to side with Dr. McDonald here. On the micro level, I am sure they know very well that they are slithery and deceptive in their conduct. But on the macro level, I think there is a lot of self-deception at play." And he goes on a little later to explain what he means by that. "I see their need to destroy Europeans as an emotional compulsion that they are mostly not self-aware of. A circumspect, self-aware, not self-deceiving organism would not be hell-bent on destroying its host or undertaking the other ultimately self-destructive policies that we see." An important thing to see there is what he's saying is he doesn't believe that the Jews are self-destructive. That's impossible to believe. And the funny thing is, though, that this is something that we're supposed to believe about whites. The standard, what I call the suicide meme, the standard excuse for given to people who see that something is going wrong is, well, we're doing this all to ourselves. This is suicidal. And that we're supposed to accept. Personally, I don't think that any organism, any group is evolved to destroy itself, to be suicidal. We didn't get to where we are by being suicidal as a group. There may be suicidal strains, individuals who are suicidal, and there may be some groups who want other groups to be killed off, but it's not suicide. And I've been over that many times. Another aspect of this comment from Andrew I see is some black and white thinking here, this sort of false dichotomy. There's actually a range of behaviors in any group, and including the Jews. The Jews have this saying that they like to use, two Jews, three opinions about what's best for the Jews. And actually, that what's best for the Jews is me making the point that, yeah, the two Jews have three opinions, and those three opinions are all centered around their one central question that they're always asking themselves, what's best for the Jews? And whether they're sincere about it or not, that is the premise for whatever arguments they have about their Jewishness. The Jews don't have to be hell-bent on white destruction as a whole or not. And it's better if whites just see things as what's best for whites. Is it a good idea to allow these Jews to run around free amongst whites, pretending to be white and telling whites what to do? On the one side, you have Tim Wise type Jews who are destructive, hell-bent on white destruction. And on the other, you have Jews like Lawrence Oster, who fool many whites into thinking that he's a good Jew because he converted to Christianity. And he writes about race, and he writes about how white people should stand up and defend themselves. But he's, like Tim Wise, and maybe even more explicitly than Tim Wise, thinking about what's best for the Jews. That's what his motivation is. He's combating anti-Semitism, sniffing it out and trying to snuff it out. And that's his priority. That was his priority until he died. And in a way, these right-wing Jews, these conservative or quote-unquote good Jews, they don't want the white race to disappear. They think the white race has been a good thing for the Jews. In Oster's case, he thought that America was the most wonderful place that the Jews had ever had, that they had thrived in the America of his youth, and he saw them basically destroying it. Although this is where this issue of self-deception comes in. He still pretended as if it was religion, maybe not as strenuously as most other Jews do. And he only defended whites to the extent that he wanted them to preserve this environment for the Jews. He wanted them, whites, to stand up and resist Muslims, but and blacks and mestizos. But whenever he talked about those other groups, you could see how his arguments could be used just as well against Jews. But if you tried to actually point that out to him, then you were condemned. He would condemn people like that as anti-Semites and refuse to have anything further to say to them or anything further to argue about it. I mean, that's the way that whites should be too. Once it's clear that somebody is anti-white, there's no sense in trying to argue or discuss things with them any further. They've identified themselves as an enemy. But again, back to self-deception. The point I've made in the past about self-deception is that in its most literal sense, it's about lying to oneself, to protect oneself. It's a very personal thing. It's a personal mechanism for dealing with a personal problem to avoid the mental anguish of something, of a reality that's anguishing, that's painful to face. And so instead we make up lies to ourselves about what's really going on. Denial is another word that comes to mind for that kind of self-deception. And that kind of self-deception I see whites engaging in. And that is the true self-deception, I think, even of telling ourselves that Jews are self-deceiving themselves, that they don't really know what's going on, that they're just doing what they have to do instinctually. I mean, there are instincts that the Jews have and inborn personality traits, but I think when it comes to whether to destroy their enemies or not, that is something that they consciously organize to do. They're hyper-conscious of that, and they see whites as the enemy. Related to this white self-deception, a good part of it is triggered by the Jews, because just like with the urging whites to see Jews as a religion, they'll also, whenever whites start thinking, hey, these Jews are behind all of these destructive things that are harming whites, you know, it'll be a Jew there right away suggesting, hey, it's not the Jews, it's not the Jews. There's no Jewish conspiracy. That's just crazy talk. And whites pick up on that and start telling themselves that. Now, I'd like to return to the book that I read a section from in part one. Eric Goldstein wrote this book, The Price of Whiteness. And he's talking about how 100 years ago, everyone, including the Jews, regarded the Jews as a race, thought of them in racial terms. And though whites saw Jews as a distinct race, they saw them in a positive light as a part of the white family of races. But what's important about this book is it sheds light on Jews discussing and strategizing amongst themselves how to be seen, how to see themselves for themselves, and how to urge others to see them, how to compel others to see them, but always with their best interests in mind. From page 16 of that book, in a section titled Race as a Framework for American Jewish Identity, Jews had long been understood as a, quote, race, unquote, in Western societies. According to Yosef Hayim Yerushalmi, racial terminology was applied to the Jews as early as the 15th century, when purity of blood statutes were enacted in Spain to restrict Christians of Jewish descent from holding certain privileges. By the mid-19th century, the opposition between, quote, Aryan, unquote, and, quote, Semite, unquote, which had grown out of the study of philology, had become an orthodoxy of racial science in Europe. I'll inject right here to say that, yes, the distinction between Aryan and Semite started out, grew out of the study of language, but it was also backed up by archaeology, by digging and an interest in history generally. And yes, it folded in to race science. An understanding of race was not just biological. It was also augmented by and reinforced by discoveries and understanding in language and archaeology, despite what this tricky wording here tries to imply, that it was somehow an imaginary distinction. Goldstein continues, in America, however, where racial theories grew in response to a history of colonization, slavery, and westward expansion, Jews did not become a primary focus of racial discourse. White Americans spoke of the Anglo-Saxon heritage that had endowed them with a talent for good government and contrasted themselves to African Americans, Native Americans, and other peoples of color. But despite the national preoccupation with these groups, by the mid-19th century, there were also a number of European immigrant populations, mainly the Irish, Germans, and Jews, who began to be referred to in racial terms as they became more prevalent on the American scene. So what Goldstein's describing here is the contrast between how Jews were seen in Europe, where there were only white people, and so Jews were obviously, they stood out more in Europe, as opposed to America, where there were also blacks and other non-whites. And he points out that as the number of immigrants grew, and he specifically mentions the Irish and Germans, that the Jews became more obvious even in America. And I would say there, what he's leaving out is that it was really not so much that Jews were coming to America. There were more, but also their behavior is what set them apart, and that their quick rise to power is what alarmed Americans and made Americans realize that the Jews saw themselves as distinct. And the other thing that made Americans, white Americans, the Anglo-Saxons and the Germans and the Irish all recognized that the Jews were a different people was that the Jews themselves saw themselves as a different people, as a distinct people. Jews have long been understood as a race because that fits the reality. And one common euphemism Jews use for this biological racial nature of themselves is peoplehood. They see themselves as a people connected biologically by heritage, by descent. Goldstein makes a reference here to purity of blood statutes. There's some interesting information I'll link that's called Limpieza de Sangre. The Iberian Reconquista and Inquisition is just one of many instances in history, like when the National Socialists came to power in Germany, where the native Europeans recognized the Jews for what they were and at least partially recognized them and partially exposed them and were able to interfere with the infiltration and exploitation and manipulation that the Jews otherwise normally are able to get away with. The Jewish parasitism and the pursuit of their own interests over the interests of their host. As MacDonald described it, fundamentally the Inquisition should be seen as a defensive reaction to the economic and political domination of the new Christians, quote unquote, new Christians. Well, this price of whiteness provides some insight into how seriously Jews take their identity, how they organize and argue about how to see themselves and how to manipulate others into how to see them. It's a white like us. 100 years ago, that was the consensus. And they're still doing it today.